Attitude with Arnie Arneson. Arnie is not here today. She's out of town, so I'll be your host. I'm Ken Barnes, normally her producer. I want to welcome everybody to the show. Well, I'll do Arnie's weather report. It's a beautiful morning. Maybe that's Mr. Rogers' weather report. I don't know. Glad to be here. I hope you all had a good weekend and have settled in after last week's breathtaking series of events on Capitol Hill with the impeachment hearings and everything that's going on in the world. We talk about a lot of world issues among ourselves a lot, and we are often kind of in our heads a lot about those issues, and we worry, oh my gosh, is the world going to survive 4 years of Donald Trump? Or isn't it awful that Mitch McConnell is holding up any Barack Obama legislation for 4 years in the Supreme Court? And now there are 230 or something bills passed by the Democratic House of Representatives that would really make a difference for the American people. Yet McConnell hasn't even taken those bills and opened them up for discussion either on committee or for Senate floor debate. And with all of that, we are concerned and we wonder whether we can change things. We're all hoping that the next election is going to make a difference and that America will be America again, to put it bluntly. Hopefully, we're all thinking about which candidate we're going to support to oppose Trump and getting out and doing some work for such candidate. But in addition, we can do something in between. I know it's only a year now until the election, but this has been true for 4 years. There is a lot that ordinary people can actually be doing. And our guest today, when she comes in, she's at another meeting and she'll be here in about 15 minutes or so. It's Louise Spencer, and she is the co-founder of a group called the Kent Street Coalition, which is a grassroots group in Concord, New Hampshire. A bunch of people who got together the night Trump was elected and said, oh, my God, like all of us said, this is horrible. How are we going to survive? But then they took matters into their own hands, really, and decided, okay, well, what can we do over the next 4 years to prevent as many disasters as we can prevent? And they have been very active doing that. And a lot of other people around the country have also been very active doing things. It's possible for all of us to take action as individuals, as small groups, as larger groups, through the media, and do something to slow down the move toward chaos, violence, autocracy, and an end to our democracy. I myself have been active in the immigration issue ever since I heard about the president separating families from their children and incarcerating both the parents and the children separately. And I remember being in a meeting about that and just saying, we got to do something about this. This is just not right. And I start talking about, let's go down there and witness this and go to the child prisons and let's talk about this all the time. Let's get the media to talk about this. Let's get presidential candidates to talk about this. And a lot of people did things like that. There are certainly not touting myself as having done anything even vaguely heroic. There are people down on the border with Texas and between Texas and Mexico and California and Mexico who are down there 24/7 and trying to just help people, people who are not detained in American border prisons and need a place to stay for the night, place of food to eat, clothing, need help in communicating with their relatives or sponsors who are in the United States, who they were hoping when they crossed the border and hoping to be able to go stay with for a while and get their bearings. And these folks on the border in Texas, especially in California, they are risking their own lives. They are really like the righteous people during the Holocaust in World War II who were not Jewish but who took in Jewish families and helped save their lives, hide them from the Nazis, hide them from people that were trying to arrest them and send them to concentration camps and kill them. These Americans today down on the border are doing the same thing for a different set of vulnerable people who are fleeing from violence where in their countries of origin, you know, there are gangs, there are drug cartels. I talked to one immigrant family whose the mother's sister was shot dead by a gang leader, and they were terrorizing the neighborhood and particularly that family, because the gangs, of course, wanted the children, the 12-year-old boy, to join their gang, and the mother wanted that not to happen for obvious reasons. And her sister is shot dead, and she and her husband decide to flee from Honduras with her family, her two kids. And they make that incredible 400-mile dangerous journey where many people died either of lack of water, lack of food, being killed by gangs on the way, all kinds of things. And they endured, and they got to the American border, and the woman was taken to one detention center. The husband was put in a different jail. The kids were sent to different places. And the worst thing, I mean, it's all the worst thing, I guess, but the worst thing was that the third child that they took up here from Honduras was not their child. It was the child of the sister who had been murdered. So this poor little girl was brought up to the U.S. by her aunt and uncle because she didn't have any parents anymore. That's what they were fleeing from. When they get to the border, as soon as the border agents heard the little girl call this woman Tia, which means aunt, instead of mama, the border patrol just snatched the girl away without saying anything or saying why and brought her to another place. And they shipped her off to be detained in Chicago, I believe it was. It's just appalling what kinds of things happen. But the people that are down on the border, I got a little sidetracked there. The people that are down on the border are doing their best to help people, and they are putting their own lives in jeopardy, as I said. The new U.S. immigration policy called MPP, Remain in Mexico, people who have come to the border at Mexico and Texas or California and seeking asylum in this country, and once they apply for asylum, they have a right under American law and international law to wait here in America for their asylum hearing and can't be deported until a hearing officer determining that they do not have a right to asylum. The appeals run out. Instead of going through the legal process, Trump's government has been turning people away at the border, sending them back, as they call it, to remain in Mexico while they wait. They can't wait here in the U.S. Meanwhile, where are these people being sent? They're sent to northern Mexico, where they're basically sitting ducks. They're vulnerable as can be. Not only are they poor people who don't have a place to live and only have what they can carry on their back, don't have any money, don't have jobs, don't have food because they've left their homes. Not only that vulnerability, but then they're sitting targets for gangs and con people and rapists coming and raping girls, mothers, who have been turned away at the border under this Remain in Mexico policy. They're murdering some people. They steal whatever little property they have. It is just a travesty. And a lot of American volunteers are down there, have quit their jobs, and are just down there on the border. And they are trying to help these folks. American volunteers, they've gone across the border into Mexico and set up tent cities and fed food. They go back to the American side in Brownsville, Texas, let's say, and make some food, whole bunches of it, and bring it down across the border to the tent city near Matamoros, Mexico, where the immigrants are staying, and bring food, clothing, blankets, whatever is needed. And they've been doing this for months and months and months at risk to themselves because there are a lot of gangs. Matamoros, in fact, is one of the worst places on the other side of the Mexican border because the gangs have basically taken over the city there. And Americans are down there doing the right thing. It really reminds me of the civil rights movement. I know that was 50 years ago. Actually, I was a child then, and the civil rights movement really affected me and made me who I am. I wasn't old enough, but I would have gone down to the American South to work with the movement and try to get people the right to not be segregated based on race, get people the right to vote without being excluded based on race, housing, all of these civil rights statutes that we now take for granted. When Obama was elected, people said the era of race is over. Well, it really isn't. Charlottesville and Donald Trump have certainly shown us that. White people from the North and non-white people from the North, too, went down to the South and helped work in the civil rights movements and in Freedom Summer in 1964 and the Freedom Rides, when people were trying to desegregate buses and have black and white people riding buses together. And the Ku Klux Klan was firebombing the buses. I urge you, if you haven't seen them, to go on the internet and check out the stories and the photos and videos of some of these things. Especially touching to me is in 1957, when a few girls and boys were brave enough to go to Central High School in Little Rock, Arkansas, and be the first African-Americans to desegregate that formerly all-white school. The first day, they are out there, all the white people, the children, the adults, even the local police were jeering them and pushing them and pushing them down, and a lot of people were injured. And one little girl got separated from the rest of the integrating group, and she walked up there all alone. Watching that, I come to tears every time I see it. It's just amazing. Point is that there were people of all races who went down there and joined and worked, not because it was them that was being discriminated against, but because it was wrong that anybody was being discriminated against. And when you see wrong, I think American values declare that you have to do something about it and try to correct it. And many people, we know people who died. I live in New Hampshire now. There's a Boston minister and a New Hampshire minister who both were murdered, white ministers who went down to the South for various civil rights events and were murdered down there just for being supportive of African-American civil rights. Obviously, there were many, many, many African-American people who were murdered down there as well. Viola Liuzzo is a woman from Detroit who was killed down there that you may have heard her name. And flash forward to the 21st century and the Kent Street Coalition, Louise Spencer and her colleagues, they are trying to do the same thing, to do what's right. Trump is in power, just like the Ku Klux Klan was in power in the South. And this coalition of people are very active in doing things. There are other groups all over the country that are taking on other policies of the Donald. We talk about Trump's policies as if it's a one-man show, but the fact of the matter is that they are American policies. It's our government. The government belongs to all of us. And the horrible things that America does at the order of Donald Trump are still how the world and we too should view America. Trump's abandoning the Kurds to being massacred and ethnically cleansed by the Turkish army is a horror show, but it's not Donald Trump's horror show. He's the one that made the decision, but it's our country that put him in power, our country that lets him remain in power. And these impeachment hearings, whatever you think of them, are an attempt by some in Congress to take control of America and not control like a coup d'etat by any means, because obviously it's a legal process and not a military process. But how much can we let our country do in our names? And I really applaud people who are advocating this. All of us, if we were to travel to Syria, let's say, or Ukraine, or pretty much any place else, really, and tell people we're Americans, and we would bear the brunt of their incredible everybody's around the world. Disappointment is the least one can say, but their horror at what our country is doing in our name. I lived in Europe for 1 year during the Vietnam War, and I remember most of my friends and me too would tell people that we were Canadian, because when we did tell them we were American for the first couple of months, they were just gave us an earful, as it were, about what America was doing and the horrors of what it was doing in Vietnam. All right, enough of Ken's rant. I am very happy to welcome Louise Spencer to our show. Thank you for coming, Louise.
Thanks for having me.
I have been touting the Kent Street Coalition, which you co-founded, right after Trump was elected. And to me, it's really important that ordinary people, instead of doing what we all have done anyway also, which is to say, oh, my God, how can Trump and the administration be doing these horrible things, but have gone to the next step of saying, okay, what can we as us, as ordinary people, do to make some of these policies, make people's lives a little bit better? So perhaps you can explain how the coalition came into existence and how you've evolved.
Sure. I think we all felt pretty helpless when we woke up the day after the election to find that not only had Trump been elected, but how many other seats had gone Republican, state houses, Congress, Senate, and that we were facing kind of an overwhelming red wave. And so being part of a neighborhood that was close both socially and that had done some work together politically, we decided to come together and talk about how best to respond to what had just happened. I think a lot of us realized that we hadn't been paying enough attention, that we thought that if we had somebody great at the top, that we could kind of just, you know, assume that things were going to move along and be okay. We quickly learned that if you don't build political change from the ground up, then you are not resilient, and you everything that you've accomplished can be undone very quickly. So that's what we saw very early on as Trump came in. And so we came together initially as neighbors concerned, but we quickly found that there were other people who wanted to get involved too. And what we realized is, as you said, it's not enough just to sit and talk. We did that for the first meeting, but then we needed at the second meeting to move toward action. And so we've been a very action-focused group. We're an all-volunteer grassroots citizen advocacy group. So
and
progressive.
How have you all gotten involved? What kinds of activities have folks been involved with? And perhaps this is the time when you want to point out that your state-level issues are important as well. It's not just about the top of the ticket, Trump and the U.S. Senate and Congress and whatever, but what happens at states, as you pointed out, governors, state houses going red makes a difference in people's lives too.
Right. Again, that was one of the things we hadn't been paying enough attention to, you know, to the degree that we were paying attention at the national level. A lot of us didn't know what was going on in our own state house. And I think this was true across the country, not only in New Hampshire. So it was, I think, also because we happened to have a good congressional delegation. We had, you know, four Democrats as our congressional delegation. It made sense to turn our attention to the state house and to really educate ourselves about the issues that impact all our lives every day, how greatly they were affected by what was going on. And we had a Republican House, we had a Republican State Senate, and we had a Republican governor. And in New Hampshire, we have this other thing called Executive Council, and that was Republican too. So it was quite daunting. And so we organized ourselves around working on issues at the state house, voting rights being one of the prime issues that we initially focused on because New Hampshire, there were so many accusations made by Trump and echoed by Governor Sununu that, you know, there was voter fraud happening in New Hampshire, which
busloads of Democrats coming from Massachusetts.
Right. All of which was debunked and shown to have absolutely no foundation in truth. So what we ended up doing was creating working groups focused on different issue areas, six different issue areas, and those are healthcare, children and education, human rights, which is very broad group,
and voting rights, gun violence prevention.
Climate.
And energy and climate. And then we have a seventh working group called Swing Blue. And that – the focus of Swing Blue is to get Democrats and progressives elected. We just set about trying to figure out ways that we could have meaningful impact, have a meaningful impact. So that included reaching out to those groups that were already on the on the ground doing the work, because there was a lot of great work being done. So we made sure as the Kent Street Coalition to work in coalition and partnership with other groups. We didn't want to reinvent the wheel. Right. We wanted to be a value add to the to the political progressive infrastructure.
Yeah. And one of the things, and this is more on a local level, but one of the things that I think Kent Street is best known for in New Hampshire is the visibility that is provided. There are Kent Street volunteers, listeners, it's amazing. Kent Street volunteers at the State House almost every day when the legislature is in session. And they are – well, you tell everybody what kinds of amazing things you all are doing.
Right. Because we are based here in the capital of Concord, the capital of New Hampshire, and our State House, we're very blessed to have a State House that is very accessible. We happen to have 400 state reps.
One for each voter in New Hampshire.
And 24 senators. And so we decided to start showing up at the State House on these various bills that mattered to us and the issues that mattered to us, like voting rights, like education, like the environment, and to
healthcare
to hold signs on healthcare, on family medical leave, so many important issues that were being decided. And I think when we first started showing up, our thought was, oh, you know, we're doing it as a protest. We might change some minds. I think we quickly found that it mattered more to our friends at the State House, that they, you know, in an environment that was so overwhelmingly Republican, to know that they had the support of, you know, people from around, really around the state, because Kent Street, even for people that weren't able to show up, we have a broader membership who support this effort. So knowing that, you know, we were there, we had their back, and that come election time, we were going to go out and canvass and hold our elected officials accountable. And I think that's one of the key factors for Kent Street is that, yes, we show up with signs, but then we also take the next step. To make sure that it doesn't just stay at the State House. We want to, you know, what we see at the State House, we want to get it out there to the broader public. And as I said, we want to hold elected officials accountable for the votes that they're taking and for the things that they say at the State House, which can be shocking.
Right. And I would bet that it's not just our friends in the State House, the people that support our side of issues. It's great for them to know that we have their backs, but to have the Republicans or the opponents, the Sununu supporters, know that, yeah, they might be held accountable at the next election too.
Oh, absolutely. And that's where the canvassing comes in. So during that first – between 2016 and 2018, before the midterm elections, there were a number of special elections that took place. And Kent Street got out and we canvassed those races very hard. And that was part of the accountability work to say, look, we know what's going on at the State House. We know how reps are voting. And therefore, we need to get out and we need to get people elected who are going to have the same sorts of values and positions as we do. One of the things we learned through this process is the importance of doing political work from the bottom up. You know, this is something the Republicans figured out a long time ago, that you start at the local level and you build your power up from the base. That's how you develop a candidate pipeline. You know, someone runs for school board, then they run for the
State
House, then they city council, then they run, you know, and you're constantly building
right.
a pipeline of candidates. So they were running for every seat and every race. And I think we realized that it was and remains critical that we don't lose sight of the importance of the down ballot races. And that can be very right. challenging, particularly in a presidential election year
right.
When everyone wants to focus on the top of the ticket. I know we're all desperate to get a new person in the White House, but we can't do that at the expense of paying attention to what's going on in our states.
Right, right. So we're going to take a little break now and listen to some labor history. We'll be back in 2 minutes.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1993. That was the day 21,000 attendants, mostly women, caught American Airlines by surprise in their first strike ever against the company. 80% of all flights were canceled a week before Thanksgiving as solid picket lines formed at 40 airports across the country. CEO Robert Crandall, who commanded $1 million a year salary and preferred the nickname Fang, was at a loss when flight attendants refused to be bullied by threats of scab replacements. Hoping to smash seniority and scheduling rights, he canceled all vacations for months. Crandall's claims to company losses could hardly be believed after the company reported third quarter profits of $118 million. Attendants were fed up with years of concessionary contracts that reduced their wages by as much as 40%. One woman picketer summed up the company's attitude saying, quote, "We're just a bunch of skirts." The strike was so popular that pilots and Teamsters often joined picketers. In New York City, 200 members of Local 1199 hospital workers walked the picket line in solidarity. Fed up machinists at United Airlines in Denver were so inspired they staged a solidarity sick-out the first day of the strike. 4 days later, President Clinton intervened to end the strike and force binding arbitration. While many saw this as a victory, workers returned to the jobs under the same conditions that forced them to strike while they waited for arbitrators to render a decision. 2 years later, arbitrators finally rendered that decision. They awarded American the right to reduce staffing level on some flights, but flight attendants would win a 17% wage increase and retain most work rules.
Labor History in Two brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and the Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Most days, Josh Willis plays a mild-mannered oceanographer.
I study global warming for NASA.
But some people may know him as Climate Elvis.
Well, the climate has been changing, 'cause the greenhouse gases we spew, they trap the heat.
Or as Guy Scientist, his film noir-inspired alter ego, who slyly delivers one-liners about climate change.
Water sucks up heat faster than a desperate housewife downs mojitos on a hot summer day. And once it gets in the ocean, heat stays for 1,000 years, just like your in-laws after dinner.
Willis's comedy can be seen on stage around Los Angeles and on YouTube. He says humor helps him communicate with non-scientists about the threat of global warming.
I think it's really important to help people connect with difficult material like climate change in a way that's not too scary. If I can get somebody to laugh, then it builds a relationship in a way that we can talk about difficult subjects.
His humor sneaks into his day job, too. His latest NASA project is named Oceans Melting Greenland. Abbreviated, that's OMG. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
Power to the people.
That was John Lennon singing Power to the People. And we're back in the studio with Louise Spencer talking about the Kent Street Coalition and all the many ways in which this group of ordinary people has organized itself and accomplished so many things, even while Donald Trump is president and Sununu is governor. And everybody else around the country can do it in their own states, too. And I know a lot of you are.
And that is what it's really all about, is power to the people. And we all have the ability to take that power and to put it into action. And that's what Kent Street's about. And other grassroots groups, as you say, across the country are doing this as well, coming together in community to make changes. And the first session of the legislature, Governor Sununu, for example, desperately wanted to get a school voucher bill passed at the State House. And it really was an attack on public schools, and it would have cost districts a lot of money. So we, in working with other with a broader coalition, spent a lot of time not only doing visibility at the State House, but also testifying and writing letters to the editor and pulling people into the discussion to broaden it and make it clear that this is something that the people of New Hampshire didn't want. And so even at a time when our legislature was controlled by the Republicans and we had a Republican governor, we were able to fight that bill back, and ultimately we won. And the interesting thing about that win was we won by 5 votes. Ah. And those were 5 votes that had been special election votes. So when our canvassing that we did really came back to then help us win on the school voucher issue. So I always try to see the interplay of both the electoral and the advocacy work. You know, they feed each other going both ways. You do accountability, but then you get people in who can help you move your agenda forward in a much more powerful way. So,
right. Oh, that's such a wonderful, wonderful story. And it gives hope to those of us who were desperately worried when Trump was elected and thinking that, oh my God, the country's going to go to hell in a handbasket in the next 4 years. There's hope that we can accomplish a lot of things. And
the key is, I believe, to do it together and to find people who can help you sustain the work. And that's one of the reasons having a group like Kent Street is really important, because you don't have to feel that you have to do it all on your own.
Yeah.
If I know that I'm working on voting rights because that's my passion, but somebody else is out there working on education or gun violence prevention because that's their passion, and they're letting me know the times when I really have to step in and, write that extra letter or make that extra phone call, I can feel that my contribution is a lot more meaningful and more likely to have an impact. And with our working groups, each working group has different modes of action that they do. For example, the Human Rights Working Group. Some of that is legislative, particularly around the LGBTQ rights. But one of the big issues has been the detention of children in Florida. And in fact, you went twice, I believe, right?
Twice. Once alone and once with a bunch of people.
And
from
a
Kent
group
Street.
From Kent Street went down, and they also took advantage of our first in the nation status to bird dog, because it's a responsibility, to bird dog the candidates on the issue. There was going to be a debate down in Miami, and so Melissa Heimbach had the idea of, let's ask the candidates to go and visit Homestead, which is 19 miles away, when they're down at the debate. And that really helped shift the whole discussion around the detention, the children, the child detention center in Homestead. So it shows how small groups of people can make a difference. One example was at the state level. the other at the federal level.
Yeah, and it wasn't easy. It wasn't just like coming up with the idea to have the candidates go, but to actually get them to go proved to be really took a lot of citizen pressure, and
right.
That's just what Kent Street does. You know,
right.
We bird dog the candidates. They come to New Hampshire and they're selling themselves, you know, mm-hmm. to get our support. And they especially in the early months of 2019, they wanted early support, just anybody that they could say is on their team.
Right.
And so we would go to these meetings in small venues in somebody's living room or, you mm-hmm. know, that kind of thing. And we would ask them, you get to ask one-on-one questions in New Hampshire of
right.
candidates, and you get to follow up. And we would ask – I personally asked Bernie Sanders about it.
Right.
And somebody else scaled – asked Joe Biden about mm-hmm. it. And, you know, we're pressing these candidates, and right. it's so easy to just let the candidates yap about their selling points, and
mm-hmm.
it's kind of unspecific and – motherhood and apple pie, and we want good health care in America,
right.
but with no specificity. But okay, so what are you going to do and how are you going to do it? Or everybody agrees that it's horrible to separate families and lock up children in jailhouses.
Right.
But okay, what are you going to do about it?
Right. So
it's
leveraging
yeah.
that access to candidates. And the other key part is to find your coalition partners. And in that instance, you know, connecting with the people down at Homestead, working with broader coalitions to try to amplify the efforts that were happening here. That's a really key piece, is finding your allies and working closely with them in coalition.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It was great. One of our allies, I was down there the week of the debates, the Democratic debates, and we heard – it was like Tuesday afternoon, and we heard that Elizabeth Warren's staff said that it's going to be impossible for them to actually come out. And our allies from all of these different groups that were down there witnessing, me and 12 of them, we all get in cars and go to the town hall and start – buttonholing her staff and eventually her, and she announced that she would show up the next day with
14 candidates.
With two busloads of supporters and all the gaggle of press, and that got all the other candidates to decide, well, I guess I can't miss this media extravaganza, leave it to Elizabeth. So they all came too.
Right.
And the media coverage really shed a light on the horrors of what our country was doing. As you said, it highlighted this issue in a way that it wasn't getting attention before.
And then one of our members, Glenn Ring, brought that back to her experiences at Homestead, brought it back so that now we have a stand on every corner, which is a national movement.
Mm-hmm.
So every Friday in Concord, and there's also one in Manchester, and one other town in
Durham.
Oh, in Durham. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
And so for an hour, we stand and hold signs to bring attention not only now to the child detention centers, but the immigration abuses more broadly, and how our government is treating people who are just trying to seek refuge in this country legally, trying to and how they're treating immigrants in general, in just such an inhumane way.
Yeah. And it has ripple effects. I and others in Kent Street have been asked to do forums in different parts of the state and even in other states, talking about what it's like at Homestead and what we can do about it. And everybody always asks, well, that's horrible. Our country shouldn't be mm-hmm. doing that. But how can we change that? And the highlight that I tell them every single time is what Glenn started in New Hampshire, mm-hmm. which is stand on every corner. Just go, you don't have to be at the state capitol.
Right.
Just go to any public park or public venue where there's visibility and stand out there for an hour every week and, you know, hold signs.
Right.
And talk to passersby about the issue.
And now we're doing a second visibility every week on impeachment. So trying to that's been encouraging. One of the things, Ken, I really want to make sure to get to, because 2020 is a beginning of the decade, that is when the census is being taken, and that leads mm-hmm. to redistricting.
Mm-hmm.
So who controls the state houses in 2020 is really critical. Ideally, states are moving toward trying to create nonpartisan redistricting commissions or some other method of developing a nonpartisan approach to this, because mm-hmm. every vote, every person's vote deserves to be counted and not to be gerrymandered out of existence. New Hampshire had a bill that had unanimous support in the Senate. It had quite a bit of bipartisan support in the House. It passed both houses. Unfortunately, Governor Sununu vetoed that bill. So we are going to try again to get a nonpartisan redistricting bill. But as people are thinking about the 2020 elections, if you need a reminder of why it's so important to pay attention to those down ballot races and make sure you know what's going on at your state house, redistricting is a huge reason to do so. So there are a lot of other good reasons to do so, but that's a really important one.
Well, that, thank you for raising that issue, because it also shows us that there are some issues that seem really, I don't know, arcane, and that's for the nerds to deal with how the state does redistricting, and it all happens in a black box, and I can't do anything about that. But in actual fact, that makes an enormous difference.
As it's
said,
huge.
The legislators go into a room and decide to redraw the lines in their favor so that people who are members
voters
of their
party
are – voters
should be picking their electeds. You know, politicians shouldn't be picking their voters.
Yeah, and that's what they're doing. And so this seems like such a mundane issue, but, yeah, we really got to pay attention to that. And then that makes a difference for who's in the legislature next time we bring up voting rights bills or any other bills, and to override governor's vetoes if there are any, and all of that other stuff. Which leads me to ask you about something that you said to me when our bill was vetoed by the governor, and that is, it's not over when we lose. That I was despondent, everybody's despondent, we did all this work, we really did everything we could think of to get this to pass, and we were celebrating that we got it to pass in the House and then in the Senate, and it's like, oh my, and the conference committee, and then, oh my God, it actually is going to the governor. And then it's vetoed, and we don't have the votes to override, and your point is we don't have to give up then. So tell us about this
and
building
our,
process.
And we had a lot of that in New Hampshire this year, and that the governor, Sununu, vetoed 57 bills. And that is not a moderate. Sununu has a reputation nationally as being a moderate. I can tell you he's no moderate. And when you veto nonpartisan redistricting reform, that's not a moderate position. So it is true that often you're just laying the groundwork for the next fight that you have to fight. And it's keeping your eyes on the prize.
Yes.
And the biggest example we had of that here in New Hampshire this year, and it was an issue that Kent Street came to very late in the game, and we only, you know, we felt blessed to be able to provide some support with visibility. But the death penalty repeal, that's something that took 20 years of just dogged work by people like Rennie Cushing and Arnie Alpert, who and Barbara Keshen, people that just kept coming back session after session. You know, they would lose by one vote or they would get vetoed. But when you know that your cause is just and you know that you're on the right side of history, that gives you a lot of courage to keep fighting the good fight. And so that's what we have to remember, that we are fighting the good fight and that we need to just keep showing up every day. You know, we can take breaks and everyone needs to. One of the things at Kent Street that we're always aware of is that people have all different life circumstances. So people are raising children. People are working two jobs. People may have a sick parent. So showing up looks different for each one of us. Sometimes it means writing a letter to the editor. Sometimes it means making a phone call. Sometimes it means going all in. The important point, though, is to show up one way or another and to add your efforts to the work of others that are happening and making change possible.
And I have to say one thing, one of the many things that I love and admire about Louise is that she makes this last point crystal clear to folks, that if you can't be there for this visibility or you can't be there for that activity, whatever it is, because you've got something going on, you don't feel guilty and we aren't judging you badly. You do what you can do.
Right.
And everybody does as much as they feel like they can do, including not burning yourself out.
Right.
And that is really important thing about leadership. I just want to make clear to folks is letting folks feel that they're every bit as important a member of the group and of the coalition, even if they have a sick child or a sick parent or sick themselves.
Right. And so much of that other work is critical work of, you know, that needs, if you have a teacher out there teaching, you know, we need that to keep happening. That's critically important work. So what I've always said is it's making the commitment in your heart to resisting what's going on in our country right now, because it's not okay. It's not normal. It's not something we should ever grow used to or think that, you know, our responsibility is to stand up. This is a particular moment in time. But that commitment fundamentally starts first in the heart. And then each as individuals have to figure out how we can help resist.
Yeah. And there's a saying in the Jewish community, I'm Jewish from an old rabbi, that you do not have to feel like you're going to do all of the work and change the world and make it paradise. But you cannot desist from trying and doing as much as you can.
Right.
And that's really what Kent Street is about.
Right.
And
it's about having a broader vision, too. Moving. At some point, Trump will no longer be in office. You know, hopefully we will reclaim a lot of state houses across the country and governorships and the Senate and the House in Congress. We have to have a vision, too, of moving forward and creating a more just society, one where, you know, I do believe that one of the most profound lines in the Constitution is in order to build a more perfect union, because that means it's an ongoing effort. Yeah. And we haven't ever gotten to that perfect union. God
probably
knows.
Never will get into a perfect
union. But, you know, keeping in mind and working on building toward that, we have so much work to do around racial justice and around
gender,
economic
justice, gender
discrepancies, gender. You know, making sure that people are getting health care. There's so many areas that we need to be aware of, and to criminal justice reform. I mean, we could do a whole show, I know, on any one of those issues and more. But, you know, the first step is to try to stem the damage that's being done. But then you have to also have the vision of moving in a new direction.
Yeah, yeah. And let me just say, adding one other thing to that, even if somehow, miraculously, we were able to achieve a perfect union and follow that vision, the meaning of a democracy is that the people should be involved. So in my view, seeing what Kent Street is all about and getting community engagement, having people think about all kinds of issues and talk about all kinds of issues and take action on all kinds of issues and maybe even change our positions from discussion, respectful discussion with other people. I mean, that's what democracy is. Kent Street is much more What Kent Street does is much more of a democracy than just going and pulling a lever every 2 or 4 years, even if everybody did that.
Right. I mean, voting is so critical. It's essential to a democracy. But being engaged in civic life more broadly is really critical. And I think that's one of the things we learned in 2016, that we really need to re-envision what it means to be an engaged citizenry in a democracy, what that looks like.
Right.
And that involves, you can't go away every 2 or 4 years and come back. You have to be paying attention all the time.
And being active. You have something to contribute.
Each and every one of us.
And Louise Spencer is an expert at bringing out that contribution and ability in everybody. She's the co-founder of the Kent Street Coalition, a Concord, New Hampshire grassroots group that has been involved for 4 years and hopefully will continue to be involved for many years to come.
And if people have questions about if they'd like to talk about, find out more about the Kent Street Coalition, if we can help you set up a group, or if you have a group that you already have set up, grassroots activists, feel free to get in touch. We're on the – we have a website, kentstreetcoalition.org. So.
Great. Well, thank you very much, Louise. We're going to go out with hopefully an inspirational song, Do You Hear the People Sing, from Les Mis.
You hear the people sing, singing the song of angry men. It is the music of a people who will not be slaves again. When the beating of your heart echoes the beating of the drums, there is a life about to start when tomorrow comes. Will you join in a crusade? Who will be strong and stand with me? Beyond the barricade, is there a world you long to see? Then join in the fight that will give you the right to be free. Do you hear the people sing, singing the song of angry men? It is the music of a people who will not be slaves again. When the beating of your heart echoes the beating of the drums, there is a life about to start when tomorrow comes.
Will you give all you can give so that a banner may advance? Some will fall and some will live. Will you stand up and take your chance? The blood of the martyrs will water the meadows of France.
Shall run. There can be no power greater anywhere beneath the sun. Yet what force on earth is weaker than the feeble strength of one? But the union makes us strong.
Solidarity forever, solidarity forever, solidarity forever, for the union makes strong.
It is we who plowed the prairies, built the cities where they trade, dug the mines and built the workshops, endless miles of railroad laid. Now we stand outcast and starving mid the wonders we have made, but the union makes us strong.
Solidarity forever, solidarity forever, solidarity forever, for the union makes us strong.
They have taken untold millions that they never toiled to earn, but without our brain and muscle, not a single wheel can turn. We can break their haughty power, gain our freedom when we learn that the union makes us strong.
Solidarity forever, solidarity forever, solidarity forever, for the union makes us strong.
In our hands is placed a power greater than their hoarded gold, greater than the might of atoms magnified a thousandfold. We can bring to birth a new world from the ashes of the old, for the union makes us strong.